Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Whiskey Neat, spirited conversations with interesting people. I'm your host, Christopher Hart, and today we talk Texas whiskey. I know we've covered them before, but a long time listeners of the show and big fans, I'm also a huge fan of theirs, is Iron Root Republic. Robert and his brother and his mom started this distillery a few years ago and in Denison, Texas, just north of Dallas, and have been making good old-fashioned, down-to-earth Texas whiskey for quite some time now, and I couldn't be happier about it. So, Robert, I've been trying to get him on the show for a while. We finally worked out schedules. He's here today, and we talk everything from Starka, which isn't a whiskey at all. It's very similar to Rumble in the sense, Balcony's Rumble in the sense that it's not whiskey, but after that, they go completely different directions. But it's just a phenomenal brand, phenomenal, you know, Texas, real grain to glass Texas whiskey. We were going to talk about the Texas Whiskey Association. I just realized we didn't get into it. Robert is also one of the founding, what's the term? Founding members of the Texas Whiskey Association, and just supporters of real honest Texas produced distillate. And we're also joined by my friend Matthew Walt. Matthew Walt is a longtime member in the Houston Bourbon Society, a good friend of mine who has gone on. He was part of our Jack Daniel's barrel trip where we went to Tennessee, picked out a great barrel of Jack Daniel's barrel proof bourbon. And he's been around a long time, and just I couldn't wait for the opportunity to get three guys with red beards on the show. So, without further ado, I do want to push you guys in a couple things before we go. We are working on getting some shirts. I've always wanted a shirt. Sounds a lot of fun. I just have to make sure it's soft and great, and that's hard to do. So I'm working on a shirt for the show. Tickets for the Whiskey Social, next year's Whiskey Social, are about to be announced. It is coming very fast. I do want to make one correction. In the episode, I had mentioned the horrible, sad passing of Dave Pickerell of Whistlepig. As saying that it happened a week ago. By the time you guys hear this, it'll be actually 2 weeks since his passing. And the industry is feeling a heavy, heavy loss to such a great, legendary person. So, Dave, I was very honored to have him on the show a couple weeks ago and had no idea how rare of an opportunity it was going to end up becoming. So, my condolences to his family. At the same time, I'm a bit speechless beyond that. Very sorry to hear about it. I don't know what to say. I'm having a hard time getting the words out. Dave was very loved. I'll say that. Without further ado, Matthew Walt from the Houston Bourbon Society and Robert Licorice of Iron Root Republic. Cheers. Thanks for coming. Matthew, I don't know if I greeted you. Thanks for coming, buddy.
Glad to be here.
Matthew's been a part of the Houston Bourbon Society for a couple years now and has dove headfirst in this hobby, from collecting, distillery visits, barrel picks. I mean, you're neck deep in it right now.
Just having fun.
And these conversations to me are more fun when there's two or three people. Not that I would have loved to do this with you alone. We've had lunch alone. It's fun. But no, I thought it'd be more fun for everybody. We've got a different rapport. It's not just, you're not just a brand or something. You're not trying to pitch me. We're friends.
Right.
So, it's what I'm most excited about when it's a real genuine sit down. But jumping in with Iron Root Republic, I don't know the answer to this.
All right.
A lot of times I ask a question on the show. I already know the answer, but I want the audience to kind of hear it and have the give the person a chance to explain. With Dave Pickerell, rest in peace, all I had to do was just say a word, and he had a paragraph of explanation, so we just let him talk. Dave was a great man. He unfortunately passed a week ago today, and it's unfortunate. He was a legend in the industry. And so my question is, where did Iron Root Republic get its name from? I don't know the name. I don't know the answer to that.
So the name Iron Root comes from literally from the history of Denison, Texas, the city that the distillery is in. Back in the late 1800s, a gentleman lived in Denison. His name was T.V. Munson. He was an American viticulturist. So if you go to school to learn grape growing, winemaking, you still actually read the book that he wrote back in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And so he was trying to figure out how to grow European grapes in the United States, because we have all these diseases here, all these different rots, and specifically something called phylloxera, which loves European grape roots. And so every time people would plant, the grapes would grow for a couple of years, phylloxera would get in and essentially wipe them out. So it had attacked during that period of time, the late 1800s, early 1900s, had hit California. And then with the invention of steam engines and a faster travel between the United States and Europe, it actually survived the trip back over to Europe, and it actually went on a basically killing spree of European grapes. The French, it's about 80% of the French grapes got wiped out. Cognac itself was highly decimated. And so they went back to the Smithsonian asking for help. And the Smithsonian had been receiving these papers from this crazy guy in Texas about growing grapes in the United States. And apparently he had discovered that there's a Texas grape root that is highly resistant to phylloxera. So he had been grafting a lot of these French grapes on top of this Texas rootstock, and he was able to grow the European grapes here. And then he started sending them back over to Europe, back to France specifically, and literally saved Cognac. And for that reason, Denison and Cognac are sister cities. There's a statue of him in Cognac. It's why we at the distillery actually have a great relationship with a lot of the Cognac producers, because there's that kind of really cool rapport from this history that we have. So it's the iron grape roots from Texas that saved the French wine industry. So coming from us as a distillery, come from a more of a brandy distilling background, from Hubert Germain Roban, specifically Nancy Fraley, and a lot of the...
I want to get her on the show so bad.
I'll get her here, don't you worry. she wants to come on too, by the way. So basically, because of the grape root and the connection, that's why we ended up naming it in honor of kind of that connection. So coming from the French distilling tradition, being in Denison, it just made perfect
sense. Yeah. I mean, it's a great name. Yeah. And a lot of people don't know that. To summarize what you just said, Americans caused the great cognac phylloxera epidemic, and then we solved the great cognac phylloxera epidemic.
So this... people from Scotland should love us too, because that's the reason single malt's so popular.
We're good like that. Those guys, what was that movie with Jake Gyllenhaal where he would cause car wrecks and then be right there to film news right behind it? Midnight something or other. I forget the name of it, but yeah, we basically caused the problem, then we solved the problem. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that Iron Root got its I didn't know that Denison was also a sister city to Cognac. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that either. So I learned something new.
Yeah. T.V. Munson, he actually was named to the French Legion of Honor, which there's six Americans that have ever been named to it. So you have three that stopped a terrorist attack on a train a couple of years ago. But before that, there were three. It was T.V. Munson, Thomas Edison, and then Dwight Eisenhower, who was also born in Denison. Yeah, so you can see the statue.
Yeah, I'm from that part of the world as well. So I'm familiar with the stories and all. It's a pretty cool place to be from. Just a side conversation we were having, that you were a bystander to the other day. Someone wanted to kind of talk some mess about North Texas, and I said, you can thank us for Dwight D. Eisenhower and saving wine and cognac. So. Yeah.
We did a few things right, so.
Oh, and me.
Don't blame him for everything. Mm-hmm. Even if you're that close to Dallas, I think the important thing to take away from that is Denison is better than Dallas, and that's all that matters.
Yeah, I like that.
You said you guys took a group from up there. I know the group, right? Yeah?
Yeah,
Dallas,
from
DFW, the Bourbon Hounds?
It was a Dallas Single Malt Society. And then the North Texas Spirit Society, I believe, was the two groups that came together to do that.
It was after ours. We were first,
it was after,
right?
Yeah, they just did theirs this last weekend.
Oh, wow.
Good. So,
how'd that go?
It went really well. Had a great time. They kind of fell in love with Icarus, which is a bottling I don't have here yet. So they're actually buying a barrel of Icarus, I believe. After that event, but we can talk about that guy a little bit later on. But
yeah. There's quite a bit I want to talk to you about. In particular, this massive barrel.
Yes.
So in past episodes, I've talked in depth about a theory that I've, I hate to say postulated to sound smart, but a theory that I've proposed is that historically Texas distillers have always jumped on the small barrel train to kind of expedite aging. I think because of how hot it is that we should be going bigger than standard Kentucky barrels if we're going to do the long term. You know, there's been many distilleries saying that we'll never see an 8 to 10 year old Texas whiskey. And I think that's true in a small barrel.
Yeah, definitely not.
Or even a standard barrel. But I don't think you're going to, I think it may be possible in much larger barrels. Slower process.
And that's for us. So the part of the philosophy that we came into distilling with, when we started the distillery, was our goal was not to try to speed anything up. Our goal is actually to slow things down. And that comes again from that kind of that French tradition that we come from. It's working on letting the spirits rest, letting them breathe a little bit. When it's going in and out of the wood of those small barrels so quickly that you're extracting so much that you're never going to be able to get a whiskey, again, as you said, at 10 years. But even with the higher evaporation rates with bigger barrels, it's definitely possible to reach 10 years. Right now, we're a four-year-old distillery. We still have several of our first barrels, even in the standard 53-gallon barrels, and they're not over-oaked. And it's, again, part of it's going to be how you care. Again, we're a little bit cooler temperature than down here. But you're seeing that if you use bigger barrels and you're not leaving it in storage sheds or something that's going to get 130 degrees over the course of a day or during the summer stay that hot, that you can get whiskeys that are well aged and not lose a ton out of the barrels. So
In the Caribbean, yeah. Their rate of evaporation is higher than ours.
Yeah.
Right. So if you can see a nice 15-year-old Caroni or which I know is kind of a shuttered distillery, but I think I think the idea that it's not possible to have an 8 to 10 year old Texas whiskey, I think, is a bit absurd or unfounded.
Yeah, it's hogwash.
I think it really and we've talked about this on the show before, where you guys have been, even you and I have had the discussions of trying to solve the Rubik's Cube of Texas whiskey to get those hyper aggressive, over tannic. Whiskeys that I always say corn oil because it reminds me of a really abrasive, over oaked young whiskey.
Oh, yeah.
The way to solving, and I'm not a distiller or an expert by any means, but I think super massive barrels, long term aging with as much mitigation as you can as far as temps go, I think is possible.
Yeah. So, I mean, we started out with 53s primarily.
Standard size,
which is standard size barrel. We had a few smaller for experimental reasons, just for random experiments that we did. But everything that went production-wise was in 53s to start out with. A couple of years ago, we moved up to 60s. Starting a portion of our barrels are in 60-gallon barrels. And we're in the process of now even looking at 65 and 70-gallon barrels. Now, we do have the one one.
How much more expensive are those?
So they're going to be – depends on the type of oak. That's another thing that we do a little bit. We use a lot of European oak in addition to American and French as well. But so you're talking American oak barrels, generally 60s. It's actually a little bit of a barrel savings to you. You can fit more whiskey in a barrel and it doesn't cost that – same amount more. So sure. I think most of the – for us, it's going to be a little bit different because we do charred and toasted barrels in a combo. So those are going to be like anywhere from 350 up to 550 for American oak. The European oak are going to be like 650 to 750, somewhere in there, depending on your char and toast and all that stuff.
Sure.
French is going to be a lot more expensive than that. In French barrels, you can go anywhere, even just in this – and in the 60-gallon barrels, anywhere from $750 to $1,500 a barrel.
Wow.
So they can get – barrels can get very expensive very quickly, but it's something that it's – you know, a lot of your flavor from your whiskey comes from it, and it's – you have to invest in good quality oak. I think a lot of the Scotch distillers, they talk about that it's really about quality of oak that you're really trying to find. So for us – a lot of the guys, especially one of the other reasons you don't want to use small barrels is because small barrels, generally, it's just going to be kilned, which means they're just drying it.
And sure. Like what Maker's does with the Maker's 46 staves.
Right, where they don't yard age them for a period of time. And you get a little bit greener notes, sometimes almost like junipery type notes, some resiny type character. Also, you can actually get really dusty character out of that. So they're going to be a little bit harsher on the tannins because the weather hasn't softened the tannins on the, especially with the smaller casks. The bigger barrels, they're going to be again, you can buy them for 3 months yard age, but for us, we go minimum generally of 18 months is generally what we like on the low end. We really prefer that 2 to 3 year old yard aging, but the French oak, we even go even higher than that with about 4 years of yard aging.
So that's, and that's significant because from what I understand is typical stave drying for barrels is usually around 6 months. Mm-hmm. Anything longer than that's considered
extra
long. Yeah. Yeah. So 2 to 3 years is significant. Well, let's jump into it. So I don't need the last drop of brandy here. We've got quite a few things to try.
All right. Well, Matt, which one do you want to start with?
Let's start with the new bottle.
The new bottle? All right. The new guy. So this guy is going to be Harbinger XC. It's a 2 to 3 year old whiskeys in this particular batch. This Harbinger lines are fruitier, kind of sweeter blend that we do. So it's going to be a lot lower rye, just about 5%. It's just designed to be, the 90 proof is designed to be the kind of easy drinker of the group. So it's not going to be too aggressive. So that's actually the low rye single barrel. It's actually a barrel that we were going to use about a year ago, and we'd actually used half of it. And, oh, sorry, you went.
I was going to ask you to hand me the bottle so I can read it.
Okay, go for it.
I'm listening to you. Go ahead.
So we had already emptied half of it into a different blend. And so when I added the normal amount of water as I was watering it down and just kept adding water to it. So this guy ended up, instead of being closer to like 100 when we'd go to 103 for a Promethean blend, it was down at like 89 proof. So we're like, well, we're just going to leave it and let it go and see what happens. Because again, some of the like scotches, especially the older ones, they sit the lower proof and cast for a while.
Sure.
So we just kind of want to see what happens. So I'm actually.
And that's this one here?
Yeah, that's that one there. So.
So this is low proof.
Low proof.
It smells really good. I really like that. Right. Yeah.
So when I was talking to you about, I think a lot of the kind of classic notes that classic bourbon notes, obviously this guy's going to be a little bit higher rye. What you're looking at, a little bit higher oxygen.
Wow.
So that's kind of what.
That sort of tastes like bourbon, mm-hmm. like Kentucky
that's,
bourbon.
That's tasty.
So for those who aren't familiar, Robert reached out to me probably a year ago, yeah. And we had lunch. We had just a discussion about Texas whiskey has always had kind of a traditionally completely different profile than what we think of as Kentucky profile. Mm-hmm. And Kentucky profile includes Indiana. But essentially, it's got that real classic bourbon note. And Texas has always –
Western profile.
Yeah. Texas has always not had that note. Mm-hmm. We're a different beast. And we've been – every distillery in the state's been trying to find a way to not necessarily mimic, but kind of – meet some expectations from the average consumer who gets caught off guard when they expect to taste one thing and they don't. And it's a Rubik's cube that no one's been able to quite solve. This is pretty damn close. Nose on it reminds me of some Bardstown, like some watered down, not watered down, but some cut 1792.
Mm-hmm. And that's what kind of struck me with the pull, because typically our goal is not to create a Kentucky profile bourbon because sure. they already do that fantastically. So we want to create kind of our own, kind of take it on our own. That's why we use those heirloom corns, the red corn, the purple corn. But what I've been talking with you about for the past couple of years is, can we find a way where we bridge the gap between what is
so that Kentucky? It's not so different.
Right. Right. Yeah, so it's a little bit more of a bridge. And that's, and I postulated at that time that, again, if we added a little bit more rye to the mash bill, if we got a lot more oxidation, which again, this was from a half-filled barrel, so it's a lot more oxidation. Again, it's why I love a lot of those low-fill casks, because they get a lot of those oxidative notes. They're sure. just so beautiful. And this guy's been sitting there a little bit at that lower proof, and that I think we can create things that are a little bit more similar to Kentucky bourbon if you choose to, essentially. And that was been kind of some of the experiments we've been running at the distillery, is just seeing where on that spectrum we really want to be. Because you can do stuff that's really different. I mean, you could create buckwheat bourbon, sure. and do some really, or quinoa bourbon, or do, you know, some things that are really out there. But yeah, our goal is always to create something that's really flavorful and great. We still want it to be, it's still bourbon, but also kind of have our own twist on it too.
MB Roland is doing a bourbon or a hemp whiskey.
Yeah.
Made from hemp. So, and it tastes bizarre, like way different than what you do. But yeah, so when we had the discussion oh so long ago about what makes the difference between Texas whiskey and Kentucky, I theorized it had to be the size of the cask because we were going so low. Why aren't any Texas distillers using 53s? And that's when Robert told me we are. So I originally thought my theory was burst. Mm-hmm. And but then I thought, okay, different climate. I can't just cap it at the standard 53. Mm-hmm. And then now my theory has changed a little bit to a much larger barrel with more – in particular, the larger surface area, mm-hmm. you know, or the actually it'd be a less surface area to water ratio.
Right, correct.
And that way you're giving, you're taking it a much slower time to get there as opposed to, you know, because it's similar to when if you're baking a cake and it tells you to bake a cake at 375 for 15 minutes and you have a cake, but baking a cake in Texas, we can't get to 375. We cook at 700 degrees.
That's right.
So you've got to
if you have a bigger oven.
A bigger oven, and it's not a completely sound analogy mm-hmm. because in this with a cake you'd have to cook faster.
Right.
But in this case, we're wanting to a bigger barrel, a slower process. Mm-hmm. That's my theory.
Another element to that having the larger cask is you've got a lot more mass there. So it's going to hold its temperature better than a small cask, and it's going to see those bigger temperature swings.
Insulated.
Exactly. It's going to be pulling in and out of that wood that much faster. So I think it's a pretty fun theory. I can't wait to see where it goes.
And that's half the fun as a small distiller. I hate using the word craft distillery, but
sorry to interrupt you real quick. Did you let anyone – no, you don't know the guys from Avanac. Okay, never mind.
No.
Disregard.
But it's been – again, we're always trying to create more flavors when we're sitting down at a blending table. So where a lot of distilleries are coming in and they're creating one mash bill and they're creating a bunch of those and trying to put that together. For us, we have 10 different mash bills. Again, the low rye is actually one of them that we do. And playing around with different barrel entry proofs for those. And again, it's because we want all the barrels to be a little bit different. So when we go to the blending table, we have as many options as possible to really get to that best blend that we can do. So I think what I love about all the Japanese blenders is that they're not necessarily blending to, I want it to taste exactly like this necessarily, but they want it to be better than what they, not the last blend. So they want the same profile, but they're always looking to make something better than what you're making before. And as a young distillery, that's always our goal when we're putting together the blend. So what if we had this other little flavor here that we can blend in? Would that make it more complex?
Sure.
And sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't turn out as well. And so it's one of those things that it's you're learning along going with it, which is why anyone who hasn't been distilling for several decades, when they start throwing around the term master distiller or master blender, it gives me a kind of a chuckle, because I know that, you know, I've been at this now for nearly a decade of working on these skills, and it's still, you know, it's a lifelong process of learning. And I think that if you don't acknowledge that you just crown yourself
King.
Yeah. I think you're not acknowledging that how much room you still have to grow. And I think that's for us, I think that's the most exciting thing about Texas whiskey. You taste the whole of the Texas whiskeys today versus what was out there 3 years ago, and it's a whole different beast. The whiskeys are so much better than they were 3 years ago. I think that's why you're starting to see so much interest in Texas whiskey. Like for us, this month alone, we've had writers out of the UK and Europe. We've had three or four of them buy the distillery because they're writing books, and they're part of their stop on American whiskey is they're coming from Texas. And Texas is part of that trail that they're going to be doing, where they go Texas, Kentucky, Indiana, and then I think there's a few in Chicago, and then up to Canada and New York, and then they're out of the country, and that's what they're looking at. And to me, that's so fascinating that there's so much interest in this really, really young industry, but that's because I think there's so much promise in what's being made right now.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. And in particular, this I could drink the hell out of this.
Mm-hmm.
A lot
it's
of it.
So good. Mm-hmm.
So, and this is just one barrel.
We've got more going. We've actually got some that are higher rye as well.
Sure.
To this, but what this experiment really told us is that one, that the oxidative notes are one of the things that we need to focus on even more than we already do. One, we may look at doing some lower entry proof or letting the barrel, at least watering the cask down even a little bit more in barrel, letting it sit longer, because obviously some of those vanillas and caramels are so prevalent in some of the Kentucky whiskeys. It's coming out in the lower proof, which means it's more water-soluble flavors. With shorter amount of time, you get those water-soluble flavors out of the barrel, like the vanillins and whatnot. much quicker at a lower proof. And so that may be what we're seeing as well. So it gives me a lot of indications, kind of some directions we can go for that, a little, again, that traditional flavor profile versus a lot of what we do, which has those purple corns and those red corns, which again is what makes XC to me so sweet and fruity, are a lot of those specialty corns that we're using.
What's the XC stand for?
90. So it's the 90 proof whiskey. So we try to be creative, but sometimes it's.
I had to ask the same question whenever I first saw it. I have to say, I usually you can pick something up and smells like Texas.
Yeah, yeah.
This doesn't smell like Texas.
And just for the record, there's nothing wrong with Texas.
Yes.
It's grown so much, and it is the only industry. People are complaining that with Kentucky, that it was the old days was the good juice, and that the juice has gone down in quality because they're trying to ramp up production. Whereas Texas, it's the other direction. Texas is shooting up. When it first came out, it was this very aggressive, very corn-forward, very oily, like too oily, oak water, to the point that it just tasted like corn and wood. And not you. Some of the early producers, you know, and even those early producers, I mean, 5 years ago, about Garrison Brothers changed Garrison Brothers changed a couple of the production methods. And now what's being released in 2018, in my opinion, and a lot of people that I respect's opinion, that the current releases of Garrison Brothers is the best it's ever been.
Right.
In particular, what they used to do is they would age the barrels in shipping containers, and it would get like 190 degrees, really literally cooking the whiskey
again.
And it would definitely ramp up aging. And I think – and now they've removed that. They've got actual barrel barns now. And what was released this year was the first time that they released this much slower, longer method at less everything, less – you know, bigger barrels, so less surface area. You know, lower temps, just tone everything down for a longer period of time. And we're moving in the right direction.
Oh, yeah. And people always ask us, they're like, well, you have to be adding a color to your whiskey to color. I'm like, no, Texas does that naturally.
Yeah,
like, you don't have to worry about that. We never worry about oak extraction here. And that's why a lot of the experiments that we're doing now are experimenting with use casks, our own use casks, with some of the single malts and stuff that we're producing, with the brandies that we're producing, again, with the corn whiskeys and some of the other whiskeys that we do, we have a little bit more freedom with used casks that you can sit there and hang out with those used barrels a lot longer. And I think that there's so much promise in Texas, in these warmer climates in the South, to play with used barrels, which, again, the Scotch guys don't want to hear us saying that because it means we're going to keep our barrels.
Yeah.
There is so much promise of things that we can make that are absolutely wonderful with used barrels. And I think that's something that shows so much promise here in Texas specifically.
I have something I want us to discuss in regard. You've mentioned this quite frequently in this segment about bottle breathing. And the air in the cask and oxidation. This is something that I assume you're laughing because you know what I'm going to ask. Here's the big question, the million-dollar question. This comes up a lot. There are certain dogmas in bourbon that everyone's familiar with, right? Jack Daniels is not bourbon. there are other dogmas like I need my bottle to breathe, right? So I'll pour it in a glass, I'll leave it alone for 15 minutes, come back to it and let it breathe. Which I think is complete – I try not to cuss too much on this show. It's complete garbage. In my opinion, it's garbage. And I'd like your input on it.
The breathing in the glass?
Yeah. The breathing period or the idea – the simple idea. Now, it's not to say that a reaction doesn't happen because oxidation happens no matter what. Through the entire maturation process, oxidation's happening. What happens, there's this belief, and listen, I've talked about the Whiskey Tribe guys. I've never met them. They seem to be so popular that even trying to reach out to either one of them yields very little response because they've got this massive following. But there's a video they posted about how fast an open bottle of whiskey goes bad. If it's half full, it'll not last longer than 6 months before it goes bad. And they even show an example of a glass of whiskey that they set out overnight that tasted fine, but was completely milky because it had completely oxidized. Now,
it doesn't taste fine when that happens. I can promise you that.
Well, he had tasted it, which I couldn't believe because it looked disgusting. Mm-hmm. But the argument that I'm dispelling is that, one, in my opinion, because this is my opinion, it's my show, I can have an opinion, your bottle is not on a time limit. Okay. I've got bottles at the house that I've had the entire time I've been drinking since I was 21, which was 12 years ago, taste is as good as I remember, mm-hmm. is what you'll say. My wife and I have a marriage bottle, which today is actually our dating anniversary, which what kind of bull crap? Can I just say, we're married and we have a dating anniversary, and why?
Does she get you good bottles of whiskey for the dating anniversary? Then to me, that's worth it.
No. I mean, I love her to death, and she's way out of my league. But I'm not going to push my luck. But today's our dating anniversary. And every year on our wedding anniversary, when we got married, we bought a bottle of Balvenie 15-year-old. Mm-hmm. And every year, we take one pour out of it. And if you do the math, one pour each should last about 10 years. By the time we turn, because we didn't have a lot of money, mm-hmm. when we first got married, a $1,500 bottle, way out of my price range, but it was a special occasion. Bottle's about a little over halfway gone, and we've been together 6 years, married 6 years, together 12. The bottle tastes fantastic, mm-hmm. just as good as I remember. And it's been half empty for 2 years at the halfway mark, mm-hmm. but it's been open for 6 years. Bottle's great. Yeah. I'm rambling. What's your opinion on the matter?
Well, I guess we'll start with a couple of things. So leaving whiskey in an open glass overnight or even generally for a few hours, especially if it's low fill, it does oxidize. It's going to turn milky. The flavor is going to fall apart. It really, the whiskey, if you leave it overnight, it's not going to taste very good at all by the next day.
Sure.
Especially for non-chill filtered whiskeys that haven't gone through and been
– Right. All the fats, like when you leave a can – or not a can, but a iron skillet of bacon grease overnight, it turns milky because all those fats solidify. Mm-hmm. Totally get it. No disagreement there.
So that happens. Again, especially if you have a fan going above, that actually will
– You've got constant air movement going over the top of it.
It's going to happen a lot faster. As far as open bottles, will it change in the bottle over time? Eventually, it does. Does it change very quickly? Is it going to ruin the whiskey? Is it going to do it? That's probably not. Now, if you have a whiskey bottle that's about that full and you're just leaving it there in sunlight and you're opening it all the time.
Completely different.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So the idea being simply that a barrel – in its simplicity, is a bottle. Not only that, it's a bad bottle because guess what? It's porous. It has actual – it breathes. Mm-hmm. You've got a living wooden container that breathes and exchanges air and oxygen, and that whiskey is oxidizing and maturing for Kentucky sometimes, mm-hmm. 21 years. I don't know if you've had – Whoop and Holler, which was 28 years.
I have not had that 28-year-old.
It was garbage. Don't worry about it. But the whole idea is that by the time you pull out, let's say, give you an example. We bought a barrel of Four Roses for my wife called Good Golly Miss mm-hmm. Molly. Four Roses, it was 9 years, 8 months, or something like that. And when we picked the barrel, it had a third left in the barrel, which means if it was a bottle of whiskey, there was this much left. Mm-hmm.
Those and are it the was best barrels, by the way.
I don't want to overhype it because that came up last night. But it was our favorite of the three barrels that we picked. But it had an overwhelming amount of air inside the mm-hmm. barrel, and the whiskey tasted just fine. It's not going to go bad. Is my frustration with this. Now, obviously, if you leave something in direct sunlight, which barrels are not, they're not kept mm-hmm. in sunlight, if it's got a
tornado whiskey,
open air,
then it's worth more.
Yeah, that's true.
Collapse whiskey, or it's open air, mm-hmm. and you've got actual air movement over the mm-hmm. top, literally affecting the spirit. That's different. But you're in a non-air, no sunlight, somewhat watertight container, mm-hmm. right? I'm rambling. The point is, I think people are overthinking it, is what my frustration
is. It's one of those things. It's a very hard thing to prove or quantify, because one, you could send out for mass spec, but the reality is that you can taste more subtle changes than what show up in a mass spec.
Are you referring to Wade's?
I'm referring to Wade's thing, but we won't go into
the results. Talk about it. Wade doesn't listen to podcasts anyway, but I'm a big fan of Wade's. Yeah. I respect him deeply. He sent out what he did was, for those who don't know, is he was on the show. He has a blog called tater-talk.com. He did a 1-year experiment with a bottle, an open bottle of Four Roses or Old Weller Antique.
He's done several versions. The very first one he did, I think, was a 3-month with the Weller Antique. And
the 1 year, though, was a Four Roses.
The 1 year, no, was actually the Liquor Hut number first OWA pick.
Yeah.
He did an intermediate that was a Four Roses pick. But
so he's done it several times.
Yeah. The gist of it is get 10 people and give 3 samples each. 3 samples to each person, 2 being your base or your control, and then 1 mm-hmm. being the odd, or maybe it's 2 are the odd and mm-hmm. 1's your...
So they're the same spirit at different time points.
Right. Exactly. And say, okay, which one of these 3 is the odd one? And each time, no one can tell the difference.
Yeah. So consistently, these people couldn't tell the difference between the spirits. Now, just to take it a step further, he did send the samples for mass spec at, I believe...
Smooth Ambler.
Was it Smooth Ambler? Mm-hmm. Okay. For some reason, I thought it was... I don't know why Herman Marshall came to mind. But he sent it out for mass spec, and they noticed all these different markers. I think there were 10 markers or 12 markers. There was little to no change whatsoever in a 1-year time period in the chemical composition of the spirit. Mm-hmm. And... essentially supporting his idea that it may change.
Yeah.
Chemical composition breaks. I mean, that's the nature of biology. Things break down over long periods of time. But there's zero difference. When people say, I poured it in a glass, I let it sit for 15 minutes, came back to it, it was glorious. Or I tried it a week ago, I hated it. I came back to it a week later, I loved it. And these massive changes in such a short period of time are simply in your head. It's a matter of the your diet, the food you eat, what you ate that day, your stress levels, your taste buds change all the time. Now, that being said, I've gotten to the point with my drinking profession that I don't really have that anymore. Meaning I don't know if I've convinced myself so much that it doesn't change, that it's not even a possibility. Like, I'll taste something and then I'll come back to it a week later and it tastes the same as I remember.
See, I thought you were going to say you eat the same thing and drink the same thing every
day. No, I just this imaginary dogma that some people have. It's not even a consideration in my head. I'll come back to something and I may not like it at first because I might have been expecting something. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, in Sherry peat bombs.
Right.
Highland Park Sherry peated sherry is completely different than Bowmore peated sherry. And when you try one when you're expecting the other, it'll catch you off guard. But then you come back to it a week later, now that you know what to expect, you're approaching it with a different
mindset.
You've slept on it. And so I think that's what changes, is your mindset changes.
And one thing I will say, you go to a lot of the German brandies. They do eau de vie, clear, everything's aged in glass. There is a noticeable difference tasting, 3-year-old versus a 20, 25-year-old that sits in demijohns for decades. Again, they do half fill. They'll open it up, let it breathe. They'll close it back down. Eventually, oxygen does take its toll.
Now, there's a word for that.
Right.
What is it? Oh, I thought you were going to say it. An old bottle effect.
Yeah.
There is a long-term chemical process mm-hmm. that has been proven for vintage bottles.
Right. Same thing happens with
stuff that's been sitting in the glass. Yeah.
So it's, again, how much it changes, how quickly it changes. Honestly, I can't give you any of the definites. Will the whiskey eventually change over time? Maybe it's a light amount or a large amount. That's, can be a lot dependent on the whiskey itself, and how you're opening it and how you're drinking it, where it's stored. I mean, all those things can have an impact on it. So, whether sometimes I'll say, especially if you're saying it's within, a couple of days, you're coming back to it and saying it's changed drastically. That's probably not the case. Probably has more to do with you and where you're approaching that whiskey from or spirit from. I think a lot of issues come from is when people have specific expectations of what things are supposed to taste like.
Sure.
When people want to taste Weller and then they have a high, high rye Four Roses and their things get crosswired and that's not what you're expecting, or people are expecting this big peat bomb, especially from like older Lafroigs, and they're not getting that because the peat has been settled over, when you're eating that 35, 40-year-old peated whiskey.
Peat tends to fade over time in the barrel. It tends to be almost – I had a 26-year-old Ardbeg or 25-year-old Ardbeg, and it was almost completely dead.
Super just subtle.
Super muted. Yeah, very soft.
And if you're coming into it expecting a big peat bomb, then
– you may feel disappointed.
Yeah, or your perception will change the next time you come back to it because you're not – like you said, like you're not expecting that. Leaving whiskey in a glass like this for a couple hours – 100% will change.
Yeah, so you're exposed to light, you're in an open container, completely left open, and you're talking about a much smaller scale.
Yeah. Other thing, bottling has a huge impact. If you taste a spirit after it's run through a bottler, put in a bottle sealed, versus pulling a sample out of that tank, they taste quite a bit different. That spirit's been agitated through the, that basically because oxygen's being forced through it as it's being bottled.
Forced percolation.
And so definitely for us, I can tell you, something that's right off the bottling line versus something that's been sitting on a shelf for 3-4 months will actually be quite a bit – it'll be quite a bit softer than what it is right out of it. And I can – and we do that by pulling a sample out of the tank, tasting it versus what's in a bottle. That same whiskey, same day, they are quite a bit different. It does take time sometimes for whiskey to settle. And again, the exact science behind that, you'd have to get someone a little bit more knowledgeable than me.
So, Nancy, come on.
Yeah.
I was about to refer to Nancy. Mm-hmm. I remembered I was misspeaking about Wade's experiment. He did do one with Four Roses that was the 3 month, and then the OWA Liquor Hut pick was his 1 year. The other thing that I remembered was that he did an experiment of an immediately mixed Weller 12 and OWA versus that has rested for a while.
Poor man's Pappy. Yeah, yeah.
He won't call it that because it was supposed to, be centennial, but whatever. He asked Nancy to speak about that a little bit. Mm-hmm. She had some pretty interesting insights, and that was specifically one of the things that she brought up is how much different things will taste.
That's his latest blog, right?
I think that was on his latest post.
He quoted her and like, hey, I got some input from
Nancy. Yes, that's right.
And also, we could talk about like barrels. I can pull a sample from a barrel in the morning when it's cool. After the day when it's heated up, because the whiskey itself will heat up, you can pull a sample from that same barrel later that day, taste them side by side. They won't taste the same.
Yeah.
Because of what's being forced in and out of the wood. And so with spirits can change within 24 hours. And it's completely possible for them to do that. How much directly they're going to in a bottle is another over how much time is another thing. I would suggest though, if you are, especially if you're below that halfway mark,
maybe decant into a smaller bottle.
Decant into a smaller bottle, or just invite some friends over and do some drinking, have a good time. That's what it's there for. Enjoy it, share it with people.
The first time we met I think we had cigars and then lunch or one of the two. You tasted me through a bunch. And we were trying to identify certain notes, and I made my way through the line, and I definitely have ranked Iron Root up there as far as Texas goes, up there with Whitmire's. And honestly, Ranger Creek makes a phenomenal cast strength bourbon that's distillery only right now, but it is very impressive for what they're putting out. But I got to Starka and was blown away, and then I found out it's not even whiskey. And it's proudly and defiantly not even whiskey.
No.
It's not a lesser than, which a lot of people think, because if something is light whiskey or corn whiskey, that it's not bourbon, so it doesn't count.
Right.
Starka, give me the backstory on Starka.
So as far as our approach, we love to take a lot of these lesser known whiskey styles, or I guess my brother calls them the poppers, and turn them into princes. So you take some of these lesser known whiskeys and treat them very differently than they historically have been. So Starka traditionally is a Polish spirit that they would take, put in a barrel, maybe with a little bit of brandy, some apple leaves, bury it, leave it there for 20 years. Again, the liquor industry is full of a lot of half-truths and just outright lies, but The story that Starka they tell is that the Poles, they would take it when their children were born. They'd take a barrel and they would bury that barrel. And when that child got married, they'd dig it up and that's what they would serve at the wedding. So essentially
– any truth to that?
From my research, there is some truth to it. But again, how widely it was done, like was it, you know, a handful of families doing it? I don't know.
Sure.
I'm sure you had to have some money to be able to do it. So but from what I can tell, there are at least stories of it, again, but how much of what – I fell in love with that story.
So is it the same – and forgive help me with the wording here. Is it the same process, same recipe as theirs, or did you just call a different spirit entirely Starka?
We just call – so ours is our neutral spirit, or basically it's our gin base that we use, use for this. And we did barrel age it. We didn't add any brandy to it. We didn't add any apple leaves or anything because that's not really kind of our style.
No kids were born from it or buried.
No kids were born. So I was like, can't do the full thing. So initially, actually, where this spirit came from in our portfolio is that we originally had barrel age this spirit to create a barrel age gin. We were going to add the botanical part later on. We just wanted to get that really rich base spirit before we started playing with the botanicals with it because we wanted to see kind of what
that's
flavors
fantastic.
Develop.
So good. I love it.
So good.
And so we barreled it again and we went away for a couple of years. We came back and we were going to start working on it and tasted it. I'm like, wow, that's really pretty good. Like, wow, that's really good. And the next day, I actually got an email from a liquor store up in Dallas called Pogo's. They do a lot of kind of more eclectic type stuff, but he had some clients asking for Starka. And he's like, do you know anyone who makes Starka or know anything about it? And I was like, well, no. Well, let me look it up, see what it is. So I looked up Starka, found all this information about it, and there's, I think, still only about one company that still makes it over in Poland. But it had this really wonderful history. And I was like, I don't know anyone else makes it, but I've got some barrel-aged neutral spirit that is very similar to what they were doing over in Poland, so the original Starka. And I was like, if you want it, you can have it because we absolutely love it. And so he's like, bring me some samples. So he ended up coming up and tasting through the barrels. And we had
– The owner?
Yeah, the owner did. We had
so you know him pretty well?
Yeah. Well, not the owner. It was actually Cody, the manager there. So he came up, tasted through a couple of different versions because we had originally planned on doing – we called the Texas Gin Series because we were trying to barrel age our base spirit in barrels from all around Texas. So we had stuff from Balcones Rumble barrels, we had Garrison barrels, and we had some of our ex-bourbon barrels. And he fell in love, the very first one he fell in love with was that Balcones Rumble cask. And so that's what ended up going to him for batch one. This right here is actually batch two, the one that you tend to like the most. That is actually done in our ex-bourbon casks that the North Texas Spirit Society came up and they're tasting through some things and chose that as their private barrel. This last year we had, or I guess just now released a little bit earlier this year, is batch three, which is a port cask. So we actually took the Garrison barrel and finished it in a port barrel. And then we went to Pogo's again this year for their private barrel pick.
What? Go ahead.
I can't wait to try that one.
It's really good.
This one is delicious. Mm-hmm.
It's amazing, yeah.
Rumble is such a fun spirit. And that first one that came out of the Rumble, to me, it tastes straight like Lucky Charms marshmallows. That is what I get.
I have
like
a bottle
in a glass. So good.
For all of us with red hair sitting in the room, we enjoy the Lucky Charms, apparently. So.
Yeah, I'm going to avoid that one all the time.
So it's been a fun spirit. It's been one of those things that really surprised us because, again, we've released some kind of unique spirits. It's kind of what we've become a little bit more famous for. We've got Starka. We've got the Texas Grape Brandy. We're the first ever producer and releaser of any Texas Grape Brandy. So the very first batch we did was actually an orange muscat grown in Texas that was aged again in Balcones Rumble casks that we released a couple of years ago. We've got some more that's going to be
coming. Where's that one?
I was looking.
Yeah.
You could have tasted it, but you had to come up to Whiskey Camp for it. So so we've got some more Chenin Blanc that's going to be coming out here in the next few years. We're actually waiting until for us it's ready. It's actually over a little over 3 years old now. So hopefully we're going to be around 7-8 years old before we start releasing any of that brandy, which should be really exciting. And then we also have the other unique one that's been really popular is Icarus, which is our – basically, we take Hubris, our corn whiskey that's won all the big awards, and we age it in two separate barrels. We've basically – half of its life is spent in two other barrels. So it spends half of it was put in ex-Isla malt cast, so it got all that smoke peat to it, smoke to it. Mm. And the other half went into that big port cask, and that we have the big 500-liter port cask sitting at the distillery.
Now, that's the big barrel.
That's the big barrel. And so we're letting it sit in there. There's actually other spirit in there now because that's actually since been moved out. So we love that barrel. It's fantastic. It was a tawny port cask that was originally filled in, I think it was in the 70s. And then it was emptied up last
year. Have you given it a name?
We haven't named. That's actually a good idea. We're going to have to name that barrel. I like that idea. Chris is
– you got some ideas?
Uh-oh. All right. We'll talk later on that. And so we take that port and that peat and blend it together. So the idea of taking these lesser known or not as very well respected spirits like corn whiskey and treating it like you would scotch with the peat and the wine cask finishing and putting it together. So they spend basically 2 years in the wine and peat cask and then 2 years in their original cask, and we'll let them marry for a little while before we actually move them on.
It's funny when you're walking around back there around the barrels, you actually know when you get close to that Isla cask, you can smell it.
Yeah, that's awesome.
It's wonderful. Makes the barrel room walking around a lot of fun.
I'll get up there eventually. How many barrels do you guys have up there?
We have a little over 700 right now.
That's massive.
Yes.
So much more than I expected.
Yeah, it's impressive. Are you the second largest? No, third largest.
No, not it. You've got... There's
Garrison and TX.
Garrison, TX, Balcones.
Oh, Balcones, yeah.
So Gulf Coast Distillers. I mean, there's a lot of...
I'm pretty amazed the guys in Fort Worth. They're as big as they are for as quiet as they are.
There's several quieter distilleries. We are, I would say, on the larger side. But we're... Right now, we're building a second facility up in Denison that will house... We just purchased an antique cognac still. So it's being... Just got refurbished. It's going to be sent over here. That we're going to be doing all of our... Eau de Vies and brandy program is going to be focused on that. So we've got some blackberry brandy that's going to be coming out in the not-too-distant future.
What are your thoughts on rum?
We've been doing a lot of research on rum. It's something that will be made at our place when we're
– It sounds like you guys are primed to be the most diverse distillery in Texas.
We try to be. And maybe it's a little bit of ADD. it also helps when you've got two or three distillers and every one of us has kind of our – strengths. And
sure.
So I think that helps out. But Jonathan, being the head distiller, leads kind of the way on the majority of projects. But the brandies I get to play around with a lot more.
Well, let's talk about the brandy for a minute since we've got a few minutes left. Yeah. You just got back from France.
Well, I'll be going to France.
You'll be going to France.
In 2 weeks.
And bringing me back some Lincantata.
Yeah. Yes.
Double that order.
I'll be stopping by Lincantata. We've got some other
stuff. Have you talked to him yet?
We have spoken with them about a few things.
Okay, so I was about to say, I can connect you, but you've already talked to them. They're really, really nice guys.
I haven't spoken with them personally. One of our friends is over there now that's setting up some of the meetings that we're going to be doing. They're interested in some really cool stuff. I'm not going to talk a little more about that on, but there could be some cool things happening.
Sure.
That we're really excited about. So
nice.
But it's again, we're excited to go there. Get to again, Greg from Pierre Ferrand also was really gracious and is going to set us up for us to stay with them for a little while while we're there. Yeah. So
over at Alexander's place,
yes,
he's got a place that he lets people from the industry stay at when you're in France.
So it's gonna be pretty fantastic for them. We'll be there for 2 weeks doing some in depth kind of study over there again, kind of. Perfecting and learning more, because again, there's so much to learn, especially when you are working on a diverse portfolio of spirits. There's always more to learn, and again, it's for us. It's always that. What do we look at traditional? Let's focus on that, learn that first, and then is there a new twist that we want to take on what's been done previously?
Sure.
And generally, that's where the really fun stuff starts happening.
Wow.
Yeah. So, but yeah, the Flamme d'Armagnac, again, if you're never go over to France, this time of year is the best time for Armagnac because that's when they start running the stills for the season. They have these wonderful dinners, big parties in the town, and it's, again, I can't I can't talk highly enough about going over there during the summer.
So you've been before?
No, I've seen pictures from – this is my first year I'm going.
Okay. You going alone?
I'm going with Nancy Fraley. I think Chris Trevino is actually going to be there on the cognac side. Then Marsha, the mother of Texas whiskey, is Dan Garrison called her that, so I thought that was pretty funny.
She's amazing. My wife loves your mom so much, and that's not a joke. That sounds like your mom joke. No, that's what a motley crew of. It's awesome. Yeah. I mean, Nancy and Chris Trevino, man. We took our trip to Kentucky back in June. We went back in June to do a 1792 pick right after the collapse.
Mm-hmm.
And what a fascinating guy.
He's phenomenal. He's got a phenomenal palate. His collection is amazing. Okay. Yeah, oh, God.
His collection's amazing. Over 3,000 different bottles.
And his blending skill, I'm really impressed. For someone that's not in the industry, that has a nose and is able to put stuff together, he's really, really got some talent.
If you only get 10 minutes with him, you're not going to get to know him at all. But a single night, you need like a trip with him. We took a trip to Kentucky. We were there for 3 days, and spending 24/7 with him for 3 days, you like really get to appreciate who he is beyond the celebrity of being a liquor hound. You know, he's a phenomenally nice guy, and we had this deep, in-depth discussion one night over cigars with a bunch of us locally, a bunch of different guys that Tyler Martin and before he went to Australia, and we had this long discussion over religion. Like the one thing you shouldn't talk about with strangers or acquaintances. But we had this deep, in-depth discussion about religion and everything that happens with liquor. And he couldn't be a greater guy. So I was pretty impressed.
He's one of those special people, again, that I think spirits really – when you get a great group of people together, he's one of those people that's immensely generous, really knowledgeable, and just wonderful to spend time with. I mean, it's like getting the whiskey camp together up at the distillery. I think you can talk about it. It's just when you sit around with people, it's fantastic.
It was really an incredible day. My very first experience with you guys, I guess I met Jonathan and Marsha at the fall dinner. I guess it was last year. Mm-hmm. And then Thanksgiving shortly thereafter, and again, my parents live in the area, so I dropped by. Couldn't have been better hosts.
Sure.
I spent 5 hours just walking through and tasting everything. it was the best, and then got to go back for the distilling camp. I got to say, you haven't lived until you've had White Dog straight off the still at 9:30 in the morning.
Sure.
And then
Sheila Stokes of all people.
Yeah. And then that just turned into an incredible day. We got to taste through everything. You get to taste the exact same distillate from the same day in an American oak barrel, in a European oak barrel.
You guys actually matched and distilled.
It was incredible.
Too, right?
Mm-hmm. It was such a great
full
experience.
Distillation camp.
It was.
We did everything. So
now let me ask you this before we go. Did you guys barrel anything?
Oh, yeah. No, that's been barreled.
So when we go back in February, we could taste a year-old distillate.
That's it.
Wow. That's incredible. You should make this a thing.
Yeah.
Like a widely thing. Anyone can book. Like once a month, you do a distillation camp and then mark the barrels and people come back a year later or whatever.
That's what we're working on. I don't know if we can quite make it monthly yet. We're a little short-staffed for that, but we're working on making it a little bit more of a formal program where we do it, four or five times a year, so people can come and check on the barrels that they were there for that first time, because I think that's going to be really special. Especially we'll tag of the five barrels that were made that day, at least two of them will get tagged to hang on to, and so the group can keep checking it back for 4 or 5 years going forward.
Well, there's a everyone's familiar with the Kentucky Bourbon Trail, the Texas Bourbon Trail is in the works. So having that as a stop and being able to come and do a distillation camp and make it a legitimate thing and maybe partner with – are you familiar with the Texas Beer Bus or whatever the name?
I'm familiar with them. We haven't done anything with them, but they do some stuff at 903 that's just
on the road from us. He'll load up his bus and make trips to distilleries or breweries and take a bunch of people up there, and there's not many of those in Houston to do that. So it's a great – distillation camp, go this way, San Antonio maybe, then up through Austin, and You can hit all the core, the Waco, the whole nine yards. We've got to go. Thank you so much for coming. This was an absolute blast.
Thanks for having me.
Matthew, buddy, appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And, you know, give me one more pour or something, and then we can cheers before we go here.
Let's do with the guy that's coming out. Well, it'll be – when this comes out, it'll be this week here in Houston.
Sure.
It's our Cast Strength? Cast Strength, Harbinger. Well, it's not – you know, Cast Strength's not the term. So this guy is just below the blend strength. We moved it from where we have a standardized proofing for this bottling now. So it's 115. But I like the term blend strength a lot better than cast strength when it's not single barrel. Of course, I think
let's talk about that. I do have feelings about that.
That's a fun one.
Mm-hmm. And you know what? And this is my show, so we're going to take 2 minutes for me to pontificate on that. I don't like the term cast strength if it's not cask strength. Mm-hmm. And it's as simple as that. And I'm realizing this now. I've never actually used this show as a platform to espouse my opinions, but here we go. It's very common for you to – so typically when you cut a spirit, cutting means to reduce the alcohol proof of the spirit. Now, traditionally it's done with water, but it doesn't mean it has to be done with water. Cutting means to cut, to lower, right? So when you take several different barrels – even if you don't add any water to them, and this one's 130 proof barrel and this one's 110 proof barrel, and you marry them together and you get 120 proof, that's not cast strength. It's unadulterated. I mean, there's no added water. You can say that. You can say batch strength. Tamdhu says batch strength. Mm-hmm. Tamdhu makes a beautiful single malt scotch that's no added water. It's batch strength because they mix several barrels together. I love Booker's, but Booker's is a blend of 300 barrels. An average of 300. You're cutting it with other barrels is what you're doing. And so I think saying cast strength is incredibly disingenuous. I see what you're trying to say. You can say unfiltered, or you can say no added water. Maybe there's a better word for that that's a better marketing term. But it's not cast strength unless it's the proof in the cask. That's the whole point.
Anyway, on an interesting point on that, there's actually a traditional cognac and Armagnac French methodology for reducing proof of spirits. They don't, especially for the really, you know, really expensive blends or really high end blends, they don't add water to water it down. They add what they call the old weak. And again, they say it in French, but my French is terrible, so I'm not going to punish you with that.
Sure.
It's an old weak, but they'll create about a 20% strength spirit and they'll barrel age that. And you're talking 10, 20, 30 years. And they use that. They'll use that needs to be older so that the old weak that they're adding into the blend will generally be older than the actual cognac or Armagnac itself that they're blending it with to bring it to the strength. So when they make some of those really wonderful blends, that's what they're using instead, because you're not – by not adding just water to it, you actually are adding to the complexity of the spirit.
That's similar to what Alexander does with his dosage.
Mm-hmm.
They do a barrel-aged simplistically saying, and this is not doing it justice, but they do a barrel-aged sugar water.
Right. Yeah, syrup.
Syrup. Barrel-aged syrup. Mm-hmm. And they slowly add it until that proof is gradually mm-hmm. reduced. It's not just cut immediately mm-hmm. all at one go with a water hose.
They generally do that with – they do that with the old weak. They have the syrup, and then they actually all have like a caramel coloring that they also age. And so they'll actually take all those things and they'll age those. And then that's what, especially for the higher end blends, they'll add into rather than just adding those directly. So there is a lot more. And I know you have the right now the battle between,
No additives.
You know, you have pure spirits. Foursquare versus Pierre Ferrand's plantation.
Let's get into that methodology. One day.
but I think it's great. I think there's wonderful tradition in doing that. And especially those aspiring distillers out there, definitely think about doing that when you start out for adding to creating some more complex spirits without watering down the spirit as much.
Agreed. I think we're on the same page. All right. We've got to go, guys. Thanks for sticking around as long as you have. I think this is about an hour and a half episode. Hour and 10, hour and 15. Either way. Cheers, guys. I'm going to cling.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.